I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Karen Handel, the former Georgia Secretary of State, and Mama Grizzly, the term used by Sarah Palin for female candidates she's endorsing, has conceded defeat. Handel lost to Representative Nathan Deal, who will now take on the incumbent Democratic Governor Roy Barnes in Georgia's gubernatorial race in November. Deal had been backed by Newt Gingrich, so in the Gingrich-Palin proxy battle, Gingrich won, but he has new problems of his own, as we'll hear. Meanwhile, in Connecticut, they're already off and running for the U.S. Senate seat left vacant by Chris Dodd. World Wrestling Entertainment executive Linda McMahon won the Republican race and answered questions on the morning shows today about the $26 million she spent on the race. Here she is responding to ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
I would spend what it would take for the people of Connecticut to know who I am and what I stand for. It's money I've earned. It's money I'm willing to invest, you know, to be a public servant for the people of Connecticut.
And her opponent, the Democrat Richard Blumenthal, has also launched his first ad.
The people of Connecticut know me, and one thing they know about me for sure is that I will fight for them. No matter how big or powerful the foe, I will stand up for them. I'm Dick Blumenthal. I approve this message.
So let's take a look at the day after in politics with Jay Newton Small, national political correspondent for Time magazine. And Jay, let's start with Georgia. Very close race there on the Republican side. As we said, Palin's pick lost. Gingrich, Mike Huckabee, and the NRA endorsed Nathan Deal, who won. And of course, all of those names are potential presidential candidates. So how do you read that race?
Indeed, the race was almost more about the 2012 race for the Republican nomination than it was about actually who's gonna be the Republican nominee for governor of Georgia. Yes, Sarah Palin candidates lost. In fact, I believe that was only the second of her statewide endorsed candidates. The first being Todd Tiert in Kansas, who actually have lost. She's actually had a pretty good record of wins versus losses thus far, especially in statewide candidates. And she lost really by quite a small margin, only 2,400 votes. She could have easily have asked for a recall, which would have thrown the race into real chaos because that would have taken upwards of 12 weeks. And instead, she decided to concede.
Well, so you would say that Gingrich won, but he had a setback yesterday. Let's just touch down on that. His second wife dropped several bombshells in an upcoming Esquire magazine article saying that he proposed to her while he was still married, and then she watched him do that again with his third wife, and on that he has said that with his first wife he was 18 and she was 25 when they started dating, but Newt was actually just 16, and she feels Newt Gingrich will never run for president.
Yeah, talk about a bad day for Newt Gingrich. He may have won his candidate may have won in Georgia, but he certainly has been reeling, and his office said they have no comment on the story. But she said he'll never be president. She said he was unstable. She said his office called him sometimes a sociopath. That towards the end of his speakership, he was really degrading mentally and was becoming almost obsessive compulsive in his behavior and focusing on little nitpicky things. She talked about an intervention that the leadership had with him, saying, you've really got to get things straight, and how, he really just ignored their advice at the time. So it's
bad
really
day.
Harsh stuff.
Bad
yeah.
day. But moving on, good day perhaps for the White House. As we know, in Colorado, both parties were holding Senate primaries, and Barack Obama's candidate, the sitting Senator Michael Bennett, won the nomination there. In the Republican primary, Tea Party favorite Ken Buck won, and could one say that this is a sigh of relief for Democrats as well, that the Tea Party candidate won?
Indeed, because Buck, now faces an uphill battle to be elected statewide in Colorado, which is a state that was won by President Obama in 2008. It's a state that's been trending particularly more towards Democrats in recent years, and especially given the recent sort of drama in Arizona over immigration laws, he's going to have a really hard time with Latino candidates in Colorado. So in many ways, it was surprising that Bennett ran so hard on Obama, on the president, on sort of the the status quo on the establishment and actually won big. And it means that, you know, there was the voter turnout in Colorado was really interesting. It was much higher for Democrats than it was for Republicans. The energy was much higher for Bennett. So I think it's going to be a real uphill battle for Buck there.
But so some victories maybe for Democrats. But Jay Newton Small, just want to ask you in the few seconds we have, a big fight within the party, perhaps against the left. White House Press Secretary Gibbs said that the people on the left, the professional left, he called them, are crazy, and they're asking too much of the White House. And people like Keith Olbermann have responded hotly. You need us.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think, you know, Gibbs has always been a little too folksy and colloquial, even, you know, going back to when before he was press secretary for then-Senator Obama. You know, he dialed back his comments pretty quickly. He said he didn't mean it. He said he was sorry. Perhaps driving wedges between the president and the base at this point is not such a good thing for the base. On the other hand, for some candidates who want to hold the president at arm's length, it might be a good thing.
Yeah. Jay Newton Small, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Today, Muslims mark the start of the holy month of Ramadan, a time to reevaluate their spiritual lives. As many non-Muslims know, Ramadan involves fasting and, for those who can afford it, a Hajj or pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. But did you know that it also calls for no arguing from dawn to dusk? Vali Nasser says there are at least five things non-Muslims probably don't know about Ramadan, the second biggest holiday in the world behind Christmas. Nasser is professor of international politics at Tufts University's Fletcher School. He's also author of The Rise of Islamic Capitalism. We want to spend a few minutes with him today. Vali Nasser, welcome, and what does one say? Happy Ramadan?
Well, in a way, yes. You say in Arabic, Ramadan Mubarak, which means the blessings of Ramadan be with you. But sort of an offhand translation would be Happy Ramadan.
Okay, well, Ramadan Mubarak then. And I just mentioned one of the first things on your list, Ramadan's second biggest holiday behind Christmas. It's big business.
It is big business because the Muslims consume more of certain things. For instance, they eat a lot more lamb. That impacts even the exports of Australia and New Zealand during that month. They watch a lot more television, particularly around the time of breaking their fast. And it's a big time for advertisers across the Muslim world. Most of the Arab world's advertising dollars are, for instance, spent in Ramadan, and so is also they roll out most of their big programs during that month.
Yeah, and again, people fast from dawn to dusk and then break the fast every night. And you're right, fast food chains offer nighttime Ramadan meal deals.
Yes, attracting people to participate in different activities, including fast food chains, restaurants, is a way in which you know, a lot of business is generated.
Yeah. And it's not just something that's happening you know, with the Hajj and the pilgrimage at the central point in Saudi Arabia at Mecca. You say that after oil, Ramadan is Saudi Arabia's biggest export.
Well, largely because Saudi Arabia is identified with the heart of Islam. That's where the holy cities of Islam are located. And Islamic piety has been greatly nurtured by both pilgrimage to Mecca, but also with the greater importance that Saudi Arabia has found in recent decades owing to the oil revenue that it has. And therefore, Saudi Arabia exports a lot of oil to the West. It exports a lot of Islamic culture and Islamic piety to the rest of the Muslim world. And it has been an important factor encouraging greater observance of Ramadan.
Well, and that's had some grave consequences. As you say, guest workers bring home maybe the thinking about Ramadan, but also some pretty strict attitudes as well, because you write that in at least in Aceh, Indonesia, failure to observe Ramadan is punishable by flogging.
Well, generally, in recent years, there's much more emphasis on strict observance of the Islamic faith and much less tolerance for lax behavior during critical religious periods like Ramadan. And many in the Muslim world associate this with the very strict observance of religious tenets that happens in Persian Gulf area and in Saudi Arabia in particular. Many more people travel to Persian Gulf now because of the wealth that is in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Saudi Arabia. The culture of that area of the Muslim world is seen as the quote-unquote cool culture. It's the one that people look up to. If you spend a lot of time working in Saudi Arabia, then you got used to the way that they do things. And all of this goes back home. And in many parts of the Muslim world, if you dress very conservatively, if you do things in a very strict way, people assume that you must have been working in Saudi Arabia or in the Gulf, and that means that you're better off than your neighbor. So it's almost like people encourage strict behavior because then they can claim association with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, and by the way, we've said that during Ramadan, Muslims are asked to fast. How hard and fast is that rule? In other words, if you're in a Muslim country, Egypt, say, is it beyond religion? Has it become almost criminal ever?
Well, generally, it was always looked down upon to publicly break the fast, although plenty of people, if they're ill, if they're not of age, if they're traveling, are allowed not to fast. And in fact, sometimes they're forbidden to fast, but they're not supposed to break the fast publicly out of respect for the month and respect for the fasters. But in recent years, it's become much more a government-mandated policy of policing who's fasting and who's not fasting.
Right. You write that in 2009, Egypt's interior ministry enforced edicts that made eating during the daytime fast a misdemeanor offense.
That's right. And in many cases, even secular governments are playing to the bleachers, as you would say, and try to placate religious groups and religious sentiments in the country by passing these sorts of laws that make them look very Islamic, even though they are secular governments. And these kinds of laws usually don't find much pushback and are easy to pass and easy to implement.
We're talking to Vali Nasser about the five things people probably don't know about Ramadan if they are non-Muslim. It's a list printed in Foreign Policy magazine. And number three on your list, Vali, is Ramadan is a time of peace. As we said, no cursing, no arguing allowed, dawn to dusk. But it's also marked by war. Remind us.
Well, just because people are fasting and that is a month of fasting and it's month of peace and introspection and spiritual reflection does not mean that conflict doesn't happen. And in fact, when conflict does happen, it has much more serious symbolic consequences. For instance, the war that in the West is known as the Yom Kippur War, the Muslims know it as Ramadan War. It was during Ramadan where the Egyptian and Syrian armies attacked Israel in surprise. And part of the surprise was that nobody assumed that the Arabs would go to war in Ramadan. So in order to catch Israel off guard, they actually launched it in Ramadan. And the idea in the Arab world that soldiers were going into the battlefield, you know, hungry and thirsty, and it was their commitment to religion and country that was driving them, made the war much more spiritually significant.
Well, in fact, at the very beginning, you remind us the Prophet Muhammad waged the very first Muslim war against infidels during Ramadan in 624.
That's correct. Although there are times when it's convenient, people can use the excuse of Ramadan not to fight. For instance, during the U.S. operations in the Tora Bora Mountains hunting Al-Qaeda, 2001-2002, Afghans who were fighting alongside the U.S., the local Afghan militias, claimed that because it was Ramadan, they weren't going to fight and they had to go back home to break their fast. So it can play both ways.
Yeah, what a moment was missed in the hunt for Osama bin Laden when he wasn't captured at Tora Bora, in part, you're saying, because Afghan fighters wanted to leave to go break their fast. So, in other words, Ramadan can be used to fight or not to fight. We're speaking with Vali Nasser of Tufts University. By the way, there's an app for that. New cell phone applications useful for Ramadan. One is iPray, one iQuran. They offer beeping reminders of the requisite prayer times. There are mosque finder programs for cell phones as well. We're going to have more with Vali later today. Why is a certain breast cancer so misdiagnosed? But back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Vali Nasser about the five things most non-Muslims don't know about the Muslim holy month, Ramadan, which begins today. Vali's a frequent guest, a professor of international politics at Tufts University's Fletcher School, author of The Rise of Islamic Capitalism. And Vali, before the break, we were talking about how Ramadan is big business, how after oil, Ramadan is Saudi Arabia's biggest export, and how it can be a time of peace or war. And that brings us to item number four on your list, globalization. Remind us how that's changed Ramadan. We know there's an obligation in Ramadan to fast from dawn to dusk. It used to be observed only in countries with large Muslim populations, but now Muslims live around the world. And for them, dawn and dusk are at different times.
They are. And generally, Muslims are expected to follow dawn and dusk wherever they are. So if you're in near the equator in Malaysia, or if you're north of the equator in Turkey, you follow dawn and dusk there. And typically means that because Ramadan moves by 11 days a year, because it's based on lunar calendar, there are periods of the year when the days are longer and periods of the year that the years are shorter. But when Muslims have found themselves in very, very northern territories, in Sweden, in northern Europe, in Nova Scotia, etc., where you basically have white nights and you almost have no end of day for periods of the year, they have got permission to observe the fast in accordance to Mecca time, or the time of the most regular night and day south of where they are.
Well, for instance, there are 400,000 Muslims living in Belgium now, and in August, we calculated the sun rises at 6:20 and sets at 9:15 at night, so that would be 15 hours. That would be a long time to go without food. They're above the 64 degrees latitude, and they would be allowed to go by sunrise, sunset, Mecca time.
Right. And in fact, going further north from Belgium, it actually becomes even more challenging.
Yeah. In some places, the sun never sets in the summer.
The sun
months.
Never sets. Exactly. Yeah. And because historically, the tempo of Ramadan had been governed by the cycle of night and day, parts of the world where that is absent, it creates a challenge.
Vali Nasser, you also remind us that tyrants have taken advantage of Ramadan. Turkmenbashi, who was the ruler of Turkmenistan, pardoned almost, over 8,000 prisoners during Ramadan.
Yes.
They use it. How else is it used?
Well, it's a time where governments find latitude to do certain things, enter into a peace. For instance, during the Iran-Iraq war, Iraq offered Iran peace proposals during Ramadan. It is a time where you can forgive your opponents, where the rest of the year there's no pretext to do so.
Well, and as we said, one of the requirements is that if the faithful go on at least one Hajj or pilgrimage to Mecca in their lives. Have you been?
I have not been during Hajj. I have gone to Mecca a number of times out of season, as they say. So I haven't done the obligatory pilgrimage yet. But that is an article of faith in Islam, whereas pilgrimage to Mecca is incumbent on Muslims, provided that they have the ability, financial and otherwise, to do so at least once in their lifetime. Ramadan is far more central to their lives, because for most of their adult lives, they have to do this, and it's much more part of their regular cycle of their lives than the Hajjis.
Mm-hmm. Well, Vali Nasser, just one last thing. I mean, you've got this broad brush list of things non-Muslims may not know about Ramadan, how big a business it is, and that it's a time of peace, but also a time of wars. Can you give us a smaller detail, something we may not know about sitting down at the table at night to break the fast and with family? Just some detail we may not know, those of us who haven't celebrated.
Well, first of all, for most Muslims, it's a special period of the year. Every fast is almost like a mini family or a larger party. For a month, literally every night, you eat a lot. You eat with family. You eat with large groups. You go to multiple different functions. If you're in public life, you probably go to 6-7 breaking of fast parties per evening. And it's a time of tremendous amount of festivity and activity. So once the fast is broken, most Muslim cities come to life till very late hours of the night. People go out, families go out, shops who have been closed during the day all open up. For most Muslims, Ramadan is a very special time of the year. They remember it from their childhood the way a Westerner remembers Christmas. And it's also a time of the year many look forward to it, because it's a time of the year where they can become intensely religious and feel close to God, but also feel a great deal of social activity and going out and festivity and celebration. It's not a very austere period of the year. It is religious, but it's also highly festive, and it combines both of these things together. And therefore, at that level, most Muslims sort of remember it very vividly as a very special time of the year.
Vali Nasser, professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, also author of The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Why the New Muslim Middle Class is the Key to Defeating Extremism. That's out in paperback now. Vali, thanks so much. And again, Ramadan Mubarak. Happy Ramadan. And Ramadan Kareem can be used as well?
Yes, Ramadan Kareem can be used as well. That also means blessed Ramadan.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stephen Slater is out on bail and the subject of some new merchandise. Free Stephen Slater t-shirts are available online, along with blog posts celebrating the flight attendant's now infamous meltdown. To recap, earlier this week, Slater got upset with a passenger, shouted profanities over the PA system after landing at JFK Airport, then opened the emergency evacuation chute, grabbed two beers, and exited the plane and probably his career. He could face jail time, although analysts say it would be hard to find a jury that would convict him. He's a hero to many, including Bobby Laurie, a flight attendant, freelance journalist, and author of the book, Plainly Speaking, a collection of stories from his blog, UpAndAgay.com, about his life as a flight attendant. He joins us by cell phone from Sky Harbor International Airport in Phoenix, getting ready to go to work. And Bobby, on your blog, you applaud Stephen Slater. Why?
I do applaud him. You know, what Stephen Slater did is something that every flight attendant thinks about doing but never actually does. He took a stand against a passenger who, according to the reports, went back at him for asking him to put their bag back in the overhead bin and however the situation unfolded. And Stephen Slater was doing nothing but his job. And he took a stand with choice words. There you go.
Yeah.
But though the words he used went off the words I would have used if I were going to make a stand like that, he stood up for himself and customer service employees across the nation.
Well, and how best to do this? What he did was he got on the PA and said to the passenger that just called me a blankety blank, blank you, that's it, I've had it, and with that, exit stage right. But just playing devil's advocate here, you know, he could have injured somebody when he launched that chute. We know that especially rude people, like as apparently this passenger was, can get violent. You know,
right.
It could have gone wrong.
It could have gone wrong, because when you do deploy a slide like that, the slides inflate within seconds, as they should, because they're supposed to be used in an emergency situation. And had someone been on the ramp, the slide could have injured, if not killed, someone. So, I mean, I could only hope that he did what we would do in an emergency and first look outside the window of the door and make sure no one was on the ramp. Who knows whether or not he actually did. And you're right, the situation could have gone wrong, but it's something that everyone thinks about doing. He actually did it.
Yeah. Well, and his lawyer, Howard Terman, says that the dispute actually began earlier when the flight was waiting to take off from Pittsburgh. Two female passengers apparently got into a fight over space in the overhead bins, and that's when Slater was struck on the head. And then the dispute flared up again after the plane landed in New York, and one of the women who'd been asked to gate check her bag was enraged that it wasn't immediately available for her. And so apparently she was the one who first used the foul language. But how often do you come across people who just won't do what they're asked?
More often than you would think, believe it or not. That's the number one frustration of being a flight attendant. You know, there are so many times, like even when the seatbelt sign is on, if it's on, it's on for a reason. We don't like having to tell you that you can't use the restroom or whatnot, especially when we see it on your face. I mean, we can't stop you, but we're supposed to inform and remind you.
Yeah.
Carry-on bags. So they're everywhere because so many airlines are charging to check bags. And then everyone comes on the airplane and they overpack and they overstuff them. And then they ask the flight attendants to put them up in the overhead bin for them. And then that puts us at risk for getting an on-the-job injury and being out of work.
Yeah.
Cell phones and electronic devices. We're asking you to turn them off for a reason. And telling you 2, 3, and 4 times the boarding door closing announcement is in the safety demo. And then we're telling you in person.
Well, so here you are flying today, Bobby Laurie, about to take off. What's the mood in the airport? Are people talking about this? Can you feel this story with your interaction with passengers?
I can. People are talking about it. People generally, from what I've been hearing, applaud him for what he did. And I think it brought light to the situation that flight attendants are not just on board an aircraft to serve someone a Coke. They are there primarily for your safety.
But tell me, are people being nicer?
Yes, honestly, I think people are being nicer. People are using it as a conversation point to start talking to us about it. There's just a little bit more friendliness out there after this incident.
Well, they're not sure what you're going to do.
That's exactly true.
That's Bobby Lori, a flight attendant and freelance journalist, author of the book Plainly Speaking, a collection of stories from his blog, upupandagay.com. About to take off right now. Bobby, thanks for speaking with us.
Robert, thanks so much.
I will never hear that song the same way again. Back in 30 seconds, here now. A Los Angeles woman who underwent a radical mastectomy only to find out she never had breast cancer today was awarded $198,000 from the Los Angeles Board of Supervisors. The county admitted that it had failed to review the pathologist's diagnosis of breast cancer. And surprisingly, this false diagnosis is not uncommon. Pathologists quoted in the New York Times say they've had a 30-year history of confusion in diagnosing certain kinds of breast cancers. One study shows that up to 17% of a certain kind of breast cancer is misdiagnosed. Reporter Stephanie Saul looked into the issue in the Times investigation. She joins us now. And Stephanie, again, we are not talking about all types of breast cancer, but instead a very specific kind that hasn't spread. It's a non-invasive lesion. What is it?
It's called ductal carcinoma in situ, and it's cancer in place. In other words, it hasn't spread outside the duct.
And these are primarily lesions. They're much easier to detect now because of all the new technology, whereas decades ago, you might detect breast cancer solely through large lumps.
Right. In the old days, like 30 or 40 years ago, women went to the doctor with a lump, and then the lump might be removed and analyzed. And those lumps were sometimes the size of tennis balls. But now, because of mammograms and other technology like MRIs, these lesions are being detected when they're really tiny and in some cases the size of a few grains of salt.
And so when they're detected and then biopsied and then examined by pathologists, what happens? Do doctors disagree about what cancer looked like, or is it said that there's cancer there in the lesion when there's not, or a third possibility, which this panel that came out with this report this past fall seemed to raise, are there some lesions that, if left alone, might not go into full-blown cancer? What's the biggest cause of the misdiagnosis here?
Well, it's interesting that everybody, all the pathologists can tell when something's totally benign, and they can tell when it's invasive cancer. But when there are these small lesions called DCIS, and they're non-invasive, there's a great deal of inaccuracy in the diagnosis, a great deal of disagreement. And there seems to be a great deal of confusion among pathologists over exactly what DCIS looks like. Some might say it's DCIS and another might say it's not. And there was one study headed up by some doctors at Beth Israel Deaconess that found 17% disagreement among pathologists as to what cases were DCIS. And interestingly, they said this was probably the best case scenario. The pathologists in that study who were reading the breast slides initially were actually from top-notch institutions.
So there's been sort of an agreement that there's disagreement, and doctors have known about this for a while. You're right, this has been written about in medical journals, but particularly disturbing in reading your report is the lack of uniformity in training or certification. You spoke to many women. One was first diagnosed by a doctor who was trained in Vietnam and had only read about 50 slides a year, which doctors told you is far less than is really needed to get a trained eye.
The interesting thing about that case is he actually recognized his limitations because he sent off the slide to board-certified doctors in a nearby town.
Right. He was the pathologist at a very small hospital in Sheboygan, Michigan. In fact, he was the only pathologist in the whole county. So
he sent off the slides to another larger town nearby, and there two other pathologists looked at the slide and said it was DCIS. It wasn't until this woman moved to the Chicago area that she found out that she didn't actually have DCIS in the first place.
And yet that was too late because she had surgery in the interim.
Correct. A lot of times a doctor will say, yes, it's DCIS, but let's get another opinion. I talked to one woman who said she was diagnosed with cancer at the Roswell Park Institute in Buffalo, which is a major cancer center, and they were ready to schedule a mastectomy, and she sent her slides to another doctor on her own who said, you know, I don't think you should have surgery at this point. I think you should just watch and wait.
Well, as you write, it isn't new. In 2006, the Susan G. Komen for the Cure, a breast cancer survivors organization, released their study. They estimated that in 90,000 cases, women who received a diagnosis of not just DCIS, but also invasive breast cancer, either didn't have the disease or their pathologist made another error and they ended up with incorrect treatment. And then Dr. Lyos, a pathologist at St. Mary's Medical Center in San Francisco, who does a lot of second opinion reviews for women, and found that in 2007 and 8, he estimated that the misdiagnoses of biopsies of low-grade DCIS could be misread 20% of the time. So what's a woman to do?
Well, you know, there are a lot of organizations that are recommending that women get second opinions anytime they get a diagnosis like this.
There's a national study going on now, but also the College of America Pathologists wants to start a voluntary certification program for physicians reading breast tissue slides. Until that certification program goes in, is there a way for a woman to tactfully ask, you know, have you done this a lot?
Most doctors don't object if you ask questions like that. Who is the pathologist? How frequently does the pathologist do breast cases? Do you trust this pathologist? And if you have a good breast doctor, they're going to be screening the pathologist. Another thing that women can do is find out if their biopsy or their case is going to a tumor board. A lot of big hospitals now have what they call tumor boards, and everybody gets together, the radiologist, the pathologist, the surgeon, and they all look at the case and make sure that there's nothing that stands out as unusual about it.
And we're putting all the onus on the doctors. What I take from your writing as well is that, you know, sometimes women, I mean, there's such fear around this. Why wouldn't there be? And so sometimes maybe women are rushing to serious surgery when, in fact, as that board said last year, sometimes lesions left alone might be the best answer.
I definitely think that with DCIS, a lot of doctors recommend taking your time, getting a couple different opinions, reviewing what your options are. It's a very slow-growing condition, so a couple months wouldn't matter one way or the other.
That's Stephanie Saul. She's a reporter with the New York Times. Her recent article, Prone to Error, talks about the difficulties in accurately diagnosing some forms of breast cancer. We'll link to your article at hereandnow.org. Stephanie, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
We've been asking, what are you reading this summer? We got great responses. Tanya's reading Stieg Larsson's Millennium novels, as well as Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Sean is reading David Foster Wallace's The Broom of the System. You can see all the reading suggestions at hereandnow.org, but may we recommend Barbara Kingsolver's The Lacuna. It's just out in paperback and still picking up plaudits, including in June Britain's prestigious Orange Prize. It's an epic novel, various puzzles with missing parts. Lacuna in Latin means gap or missing part, as in a hole in a cave.
Today, the lacuna appeared a little below the surface. It's near the center of the cliff, below a knob where a hummock of grass grows out. It should be easy to find again, but best to look early, with sun just up and the tide low. Inside the tunnel, it was very cold and dark again, but a blue light showed up faintly like a fogged window farther back. It must be the other end. No devil back there, but a place to come up on the other side, a passage. But too far to swim, and too frightening. One day, Piltzintecutli will say, "Go ahead, lucky boy. Vete, Rubio. Swim toward that light. Go find the other side of the world, where you belong."
Barbara Kingsolver reading from her novel, The Lacuna. The boy, Harrison Shepard, does find the other side of the world and travels back and forth between his father, a Washington bureaucrat, and his mother, a faded Mexican dancer. And through him, we watch history unfold. In Washington, the 1932 bonus riots, during which the U.S. Army attacked homeless veterans demanding their benefits. In Mexico, the communist movement. Harrison works for the artists Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo and witnesses the murder of one of their house guests, the exiled communist leader Leon Trotsky. Finally, back in Asheville, North Carolina, he feels the paranoia of McCarthyism. The Lacuna was Barbara Kingsolver's first novel in 9 years, but during that time she also wrote the nonfiction book Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life. We asked her about both books when we sat down last November, starting with Lacuna. I asked her why this epic span of time.
I'm fascinated with character, both individual, personal character, and in this case, national character, and in those moments of history that turn everything on its head. And I've long had a hunch that this moment of time between World War II and 1950 was pivotal to the American identity.
But before we get to World War II in the book, we're in Mexico with this young man, you know, mixing plaster and making pan dulce, sweetbreads. How do you say that?
Yes.
Yep, for Diego Rivera and his wife. And their house guest, Leon Trotsky. I thought, what a great idea to make someone a fly on that wall.
The most wonderful thing a novel can do is make the truth personal, make history personal in this case. So this kid who grows up in these very sort of sad and strange circumstances in southern Mexico is the vehicle to get you into a lot of fascinating places.
The one small criticism I've read of the book was in the LA Times that Trotsky does come off, as they write, as a social democratic Santa Claus. Did you worry about that, that maybe he came off as a little too much as just a house guest?
Well, not a bit, because I have the historical record. Everything Trotsky says in this novel about his own politics came straight from Trotsky's mouth, his intention to make the Soviet Revolution a democratic one. I've always thought that was fascinating. He was also a very kind and much loved by the people around him in his last years in Mexico, in spite of the fact that Stalin had really killed every person who had ever been meaningful to him, and he still bore up. I thought that was remarkable. Trotsky himself is a lacuna. He has been erased from history, and many of the events in this novel have also been removed from memory.
Well, I'm thinking of the bonus riots in the middle of Washington, D.C., homeless encampments, World War I vets living with their families right there in the middle of D.C.
These men were promised a bonus. It was essentially their army pay. And then Congress reneged on the promise, said, whoops, we changed our minds. You can wait for your pay until you retire. So there were thousands of homeless veterans who had no place to go. So they came to Washington, D.C. to complain about it. And this was how they were treated. There are many things in this piece of history that seem quite relevant to the moment, very current. So it was a fascinating process to uncover these pieces of history.
So in this case, did you discover the bonus riots or rediscover them perhaps and get deep into what happened and also learn more about Trotsky's brutal, bloody murder in Mexico and then say, how can I connect these with a story?
I did know a lot about Trotsky. The bonus riots were completely new to me. I didn't know about that. I discovered amazing things in the process of researching this novel. For example, when the second half of the novel takes place in Asheville, North Carolina, and I discovered that in 1947, towards the end of my novel, when things are getting very claustrophobic, and I was trying to kind of generate this air of claustrophobia when neighbors were spying on neighbors and very worried about what everyone would think and feeling closed in and shutting their shutters, and I learned from reading the newspapers that the whole city went under quarantine from polio. That was perfect for the purposes of my plot because it just added to this sensation of being closed in. I kept finding pieces of history that were absolutely news to me that worked perfectly with my plot.
Well, speaking of which, is there really a Hindu with 600 pins inserted in his body, 2 skewers through his abdomen, 1 through his tongue, and it takes him an hour and a half every morning to dress, which your protagonist reads in a National Geographic?
This came straight from a National Geographic. The character at this point is a little boy, and I was trying to get into the head of a little boy, and he's, you know, he's very interested in newspapers and magazines, and I just imagined him kind of stealing glances at what's on the newsstand. And I have in the archives all of the National Geographics running back to that time. And so I myself was paging through, and I thought, this would grab the attention of a 13-year-old boy.
We have to ask you about food, because you've written so beautifully about it, and you do in this book. And there's sometimes page after page, especially in the beginning when Harrison is learning to be a cook in Mexico. And, for instance, here's directions for making empanadas dulces. They can be triangular or curled like snails with a filling inside. The dough is the same either way. White flour with lard and a little salt rubbed in. Beat egg yolks with a little cold water, as many eggs as the housekeeper would spare. Then mix the liquid lake in the volcano of flour, exactly like mixing plaster, which he does for the artists. It makes you want to get like a marble, you know, countertop. We know you love food because of your writing about local food and the tech, you know, being really having hands-on the food you eat as opposed to processed food. But why so much in this?
Food speaks directly through the back of our brains to our hearts, I think. It's olfactory. You know, you smell it, you taste it. And the task of the novelist is to bring the reader all of the details that make a place real. It's easy to concentrate on the visual, but the best way to relay experience is through all the senses. And because this kid is a cook and he's making these wonderful foods, and I thought, well, as long as you're reading this, you might as well enjoy the details. You might as well get a taste of what he's doing. I've always thought that the least I could do with every novel is give people something useful, ideally a recipe. So here are several, in fact. And if the book makes you hungry, so much the better.